Kevin Keith here for the KNS Radio Network. Happy Monday to you. Thank you for joining us. Got a real treat for you here. Rick Snay going to join me in just a moment. We're going to talk about his podcast, Delphi After Dark, and the current trial going on in Carroll County. The KNS Radio Network, community-minded partners that helps bring you all this great programming. We've got Center Township of Clinton County, Heather's Flowers of Frankfort, The Oasis Frankfort, Wampler Services Incorporated, Granny's Goodies in Mulberry, Gem City Junction, Marchand's Window Tinting in Antioch, Sanford and Daughter in Mulberry, Live for Life Indiana Lebanon, Pizza Hut of Frankfort, plus ProBuy Computers, all with the KNS Radio Network. Rick Snay is my guest today. He's the host of Delphi After Dark. That's a podcast that if you've not checked it out, you need to. We had a chance to talk about 3 months ago. Rick, thanks for joining me again.
Hey, thanks for having me.
I know you and I have, we had the understanding, and we pretty much said it from the beginning of our last time we talked here at KNS, was you and I feel pretty strongly that Richard Allen is not the guilty party here for the murder of both Abby and Libby.
Absolutely.
And I think based on what I've been able to follow, which I think the media has done a really good job of keeping us informed on a daily basis. I watch WTHR, their updates, and also 93.1 WIBC in Indianapolis. Mm-hmm. I listen to them quite often. Everything it sounds like is, and again, we're just armchair quarterbacks here, but it sounds like that it's going to be going along the lines of there's a lot of reasonable doubt out there, and the defense really hasn't even called a whole lot of witnesses yet.
Right. I as I was telling people on my channel, I felt like the defense was going to do a lot of their better work on cross-examination, so I didn't think there'd be a whole lot of work left to do once the state rested. I was surprised by what the state offered as a case. Your opening statement is basically the syllabus of your upcoming case. Mm-hmm. You know, it tells mm-hmm. you, it tells the jury what to expect.
Right.
You tell them, this is our case. This is what we're going to show you. And then they know what to look for. Nick's opening statement was not even 15 minutes long.
Wow.
And that to me was unbelievable. When you have 7 years to put together a case and you give a jury 15 minutes of an opening. But then again, they don't have it. I've been saying it for a year. The case is not there. So,
well,
what could they do?
The 15 minutes, especially when it's so complex, you know,
mm-hmm.
there's so much to it. Now, I haven't been watching all or following day to day, hour to hour, but I try to get some kind of wrap up at the end of the day from a couple different sources. I know you've probably been following this a little closer than I have, but I think that we knew that the evidence that was already out there was going to be, what Judge Gohl had ruled on as far as what she would allow. I knew there was going to be some of that back and forth during the trial here. But you brought up a great point that I think the defense has done most of their strongest work on cross-examination of all the state's witnesses.
Right. They have shown, first of all, that the investigation has been a complete farce. I mean, they have shown several leads that weren't followed up on. They have shown several times where they have just made guesses. I thought the defense did a great job of bringing out how focused on tunnel vision that Sheriff Liggett has been, with just asking him, is it entirely possible that maybe Sarah Carball didn't see anybody? And, you know, she's the witness that supposedly saw the muddy, bloody guy.
Mm-hmm.
And Liggett said, oh, no, that's not possible. No, no.
Right.
And then when they asked him, did you ever even consider the fact that catching the Delphi killer right before the election would be beneficial for you politically? And he said, no, he never thought of that. Now, that's ridiculous.
That is ridiculous. Even if the answer is yes, and it wasn't in your heart to, you know, if you truly did follow your heart, I mean, the answer is still yes.
You know, I, about a year ago, I recorded my part for the CW Crime Nation documentary.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it wasn't my main thought in my head thinking, well, I'll get some subscribers out of this. But I thought about it, you know. I mean, it's not like I did it because of that, but I did at least consider it.
Sure.
And I think the jury picks up on him not being honest. And this jury has been absolutely incredible. They've been so attentive and asking the right questions. And it just shows that they are paying attention.
That means something, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
That's 15 Allen County residents up around the Fort Wayne area who make up that jury. So this trial is expected to last through mid-November. I think that will probably be the case. I wanted to talk about a couple things specifically. I will say that, you know, the what little bit I've heard about the witness testimony has been, like you said, quite a farce, because it seems like the prosecution witnesses, up until about a year ago when they started putting this thing together, all of these prosecution witnesses had a different theory or a different story. And it's just ironic that they've now come together and they're all singing from the same book.
Yeah, you know, one of the odd things that happened was 2 months ago, they happened to mention something about a box cutter. And I have been saying for months on my channel, you know, well, these confessions of Rick Allen, you know, did they contain anything that only the killer would know?
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, they started coming up with this talk about a box cutter, that he had killed them with his CVS-issued box cutter,
mm-hmm.
which, you know, if they had bothered to check, the CVS-issued box cutter is a safety knife. You can't really kill anybody with it.
Right.
But, you know, they took that, and then Jerry Holman says that he went, and he says, you know, Rick Allen supposedly said he threw the box cutter in a dumpster behind CVS after the murders.
Mm.
So Jerry Holman says he took his squad of guys over there, you know, and searched the dumpster. Okay, the confessions took place in early 2023. The murders were in 2017. So you're telling me you searched a dumpster 6 years later.
Hoping.
You know, hoping to find.
Right, right.
Box cutter that had been rained and snowed on for years if it was still there. You know?
Wow.
But it's just incredible. So the medical examiner didn't really stick with that line. He tried to say, oh, well, I came back and I looked at a box cutter and I said, well, that mark there could be made by the handle of a box cutter, you know.
Hmm.
And the defense brought out that he had never even hinted that before, and he crumbled basically. So then they came up with this new thing that only the killer would know, this white van.
Yes.
And the problem with that is that story has been floating around the internet now for at least 3 years.
I was going to say that.
Something only the killer would know.
I was going to say that, and I've got my own thoughts on that, and I've got the white van as a point I wanted to talk about here in a moment on that, Rick. Yeah, for sure. I saw the defense had got at least one state witness to admit for a long time, up until like a year or so ago, again, when they knew they were going to have to start singing from the same songbook, that he thought it was two suspects. He felt strongly on this.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And the evidence points to that.
Mm-hmm.
The, you know, I've seen the crime scene photos, and now the jury has seen them, and the gallery saw them too. And there is just, it doesn't make any sense to believe one man could do all of this.
Right.
You know, for one thing, nobody heard anything. Nobody heard any screams or anything. There are no defensive wounds on the girls, so they were both killed without fighting back. How do you kill two teenagers without one of them fighting back when you're just one man?
Right.
You know, especially when you don't shoot them. You use the knife. You had to be up close to both of them.
Right.
So while you're killing one, the other one's just standing there watching and waiting for her turn? No.
Right. Right.
So there had to at least be two. And the movement of the bodies, you know, they talked about there were no drag marks. I've talked about that before. There were no drag marks. So if Libby was killed somewhere else and moved to that spot, she had to be drugged if there was only one man. You know, right. One man couldn't carry that 200-pound body. Right. And there's no DNA. You know, you have no DNA. The only right. DNA on the scene that they've identified belongs to Libby's sister.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just unbelievable in this day and age.
It is. Or some other kind of trace evidence, you know?
Mm-hmm. Something.
So I think Alan's defense is still kind of handicapped by Judge Francis Gohl, which you and I both are in agreement in that also, that she's a terrible judge and should have recused herself long ago. You and I agree on that as well.
Oh, yeah.
So she's refused to allow the attorneys to present evidence for their theory that Abby and Libby were killed by Odinists.
Mm-hmm.
And no matter how outrageous you or I might think that is, it's still another suspect, another potential person or people who could have done it. It could create doubt in those 12 jurors' brains. Do you think that Fran Gohl is, do you think she will be allowing anything like that, or do you think that'll be, she's going to stick with her guns on that? She said that she hadn't found time to make the ruling. I thought that was weird.
Yeah. I think she is going to try to keep the Odinist theory out, but the state can very, or the defense can very cleverly slip it in if certain witnesses testify to certain things. And, you know, they're okay. looking for that edge, that, you know, that reason that they can bring it in.
Mm-hmm.
And with Jerry Holman talking about an undoing, he said that he thought maybe the sticks could have been an undoing. And with him talking about that, that might open the door for the defense to offer an alternative theory to the sticks
mm-hmm.
as to what could have been.
Right.
And there's no question that they were meant to represent something. They were not just thrown on there. And right. they weren't for concealment either.
Right, right. And it wouldn't have been something that fell out of the tree. It wouldn't be debris that just happened to land specifically in that, you know, that one way.
No, they were definitely arranged.
Mm-hmm. So I think the last witness the other day was Teresa Liebert, who lived near a gate on the southern end of the private drive that led to Brad Weber's property. And Brad Weber,
right.
He had some contentious words with both the state and the defense about a week ago or so when he was on the stand. Because the Monon High Bridge east of Deer Creek ends near his property, which is just across the water from where the girls' bodies were found. Now, Weber is supposed to testify this week. It might be the next person up tomorrow. And it's going to likely be contentious again because it was when he was on the stand for the prosecution. Now, this brings me to the white van, Rick, as to he drove a white van at the time, and the state says this is a solid way to provide Richard Allen did it, that's one of the terms that he confessed to, that one of the many confessions, which we'll talk about in a moment. He said he was going to sexually assault the girls, but a white van drove by and scared him away from doing that. And Weber did drive a van that was white at the time, and just about every day drove near the area coming home from work. The prosecution said that only the person who was there would know this, which isn't true, Rick. We all knew about the white van going back to just a couple years after some of the drone surveillance footage was made public.
Right, yeah. Yeah, it's been around for a long time.
Yeah, and they're
the story of the white van.
They were hanging their hat on that, saying that's information only the killer could have known.
And what's really funny about that is the they had Monica Walla, the state psychologist
yes.
that was working with Richard Allen, She was talking to him on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm.
She was watching podcasts, channel, you know, YouTube channels. She was in Facebook groups. She not only did they mention my channel as being one that she watched, but mm-hmm. also they mentioned my Facebook group. Mm-hmm. She is in the Facebook group that I have for my channel, or she was.
Right.
I've since thrown her out. But the thing is, I've talked about that white van on my channel. I've talked about several things on my channel, and some of the things that I was getting fed to me were not even in the discovery yet. So it wasn't coming from the defense.
Yeah.
And she was telling him, she said that she would tell him things to show him that he had support.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and people were saying, oh, well, that's because, you know, she was telling him things about people that, you know, were talking on YouTube about having been sexually abused. Like he was saying he had been sexually abused as a child.
Right.
But the problem with that is I've never talked about that on my channel.
Right.
You know?
Right.
So she was telling him about people that believed he was innocent and telling him different things about the crime scene, you know, about that day. And that white van, here's what's really funny about that white van. He normally would come home. He'd get off work at 2 o'clock, and he would normally get home. He worked at Subaru, and he would normally get home about 2:30. Well, that day he wanted to be gone. He didn't want to be around when the girls disappeared. So he told the police he was working on his ATMs that day and he didn't go straight home. Well, now all of a sudden, oh, when they're trying to get evidence against somebody else for doing it, oh, yeah, I went straight home from work. So the defense hit him with the fact that 7 years ago, he told them that he spent time running his ATMs after work, so he didn't get home till about 3:30.
Mm-hmm.
His house is right there. I mean, when you get off the south side of the bridge, the gate to his house is like right there.
What is an ATM? What is running an ATM?
Automatic teller machine. He used to repair them for people.
Oh, okay. On top of
working
at Subaru?
Yeah. It was like his second job.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. Very good. Very good.
His side hustle.
Right. And he didn't want to come home that day because he had heard there was police action down there?
I'm saying when they asked him what time he got home that day, my guess is he didn't want to be suspected.
Oh, okay. I see
what
you're saying.
So he told them he got home at 3:30. Well, now he's trying to say he came straight home because he knows that they're trying to blame somebody else now.
Right.
So his story has changed.
Right.
But here's the problem with that. Here's what I don't understand, Kevin. I mean, when you get off of that bridge, you go to one side, you got houses. You got the Weber house. You've got, you know, Liebert's house is back there and everything. Ron Logan's if you go farther. But when you get off that bridge, you go one way, it's houses, you go the other way and it's just, you know, nothing but weeds and stuff like that and flat area until you get to the creek and then you cross the creek.
Right.
Well, where was he going to take them to sexually assault them? There's nowhere to take them.
Mm-hmm.
And then he said, you know, they're trying to say that he was going to sexually assault them right out there in the open. And then all of a sudden, he sees a white van and gets scared and marches them across the creek. Now, the testimony that was presented about the creek showed that that creek was at its third highest stage of 2017 on the 13th.
Mm-hmm.
It was moving swiftly. On a 5'4" person, that water would have come up to about their chest.
Mm-hmm.
So you're telling me that he took those two girls and marched them through that water almost up to their chest, almost up to their necks. Okay. How did that hair stay wrapped around Libby or Abby's finger all that time? And what about the phone? Did he tell Libby to hold the phone up out of the water?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it doesn't make any sense.
Right.
And the next day, it wasn't quite as deep and it wasn't quite as fast. And a grown man didn't want to cross the creek to get to the clothing they saw in the water. So he called across to a firefighter that was on the other side.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. You know, and this is a guy that was a lot bigger man than Richard Allen. So I don't understand how they're trying to say he crossed the creek with those two girls. It just doesn't seem possible to me.
It seems like I heard early on, they were talking about Richard Allen in his phone being pinged that had put him somewhere else around the time that the coroner had said the girls were killed. And this was supposed to be a big part of the prosecution's evidence, and it seemed to backfire on him.
Well, what happened, the prosecution hired a geofencing expert to go through and identify all the phones in the area and to track their movement. It found three phones in the general vicinity of where the bodies were discovered at the time that the state says that the girls were killed.
Right.
It also found that Richard Allen's phone left the area at 1:30. And the state, of course, that does not fit their timeline.
Right.
So they fired that guy. And when the defense hired them and tried to bring them in, Nick McClellan asked Gull to preclude him from testifying, and she did.
Oh, my goodness.
So he can't come in and testify to the fact that Richard Allen's phone was gone from the area by 1:30.
Wow. Why would why would Judge Gull have take a side like that, or at least not?
It's unbelievable.
Wow. That is unbelievable.
I mean, you now have the state or the defense cannot bring in their third party theory, which they have a lot of evidence for, you know.
Right.
People say that, you know, Elvis Fields, he confessed to his sisters that he was part of the murder, that he was on the bridge with the girls, that he put sticks on Abigail's head and made her because she was a troublemaker. And they can't bring any of that up because they say, well, Elvis Fields was like, you know, he was crazy. He wasn't in his right mind when he said that stuff. Okay, but yet you're going to accept Richard Allen's confessions when he was being tortured in prison.
Right.
You know, that doesn't make any sense.
Wow, man.
So, yeah, there's a lot of things. You know, the metallurgist, you know, the state hired a metallurgist to testify about the bullet.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that, no, that's not science. You know, it's a junk science. It doesn't work that way. So they decided not to use him. And once again, the state or the defense wanted to bring him in. And again, Nick said, no, don't let him testify. So Gull said, no, he can't testify.
Unbelievable.
So we're not going to get him either.
Well, it would seem like both sides would probably have some kind of recourse against an incompetent judge, you know, regardless of how this turns out. I would think that, boy, the case could be made for that. And I don't know. I'm not there. I don't see everything, and I'm certainly not one to judge a judge per se. But it looks a little weak on the surface, you know.
Well, most people tend to want to give a judge the benefit of the doubt.
Sure.
I myself know Fran Gull to be a liar because she lied about me.
Mm-hmm.
She threw me out of that courtroom when I hadn't done anything.
I remember.
And then she, as a matter of fact, the guy that I got into it with that day, he and I have gotten past our differences, and we've been hanging out outside the courthouse showing everybody that we put aside our differences for justice. To work for, you know, for the same thing. And that day when she threw us out of the courthouse, it's very fishy because if you throw somebody out of the courthouse, usually when you, like, if people go to court together, they'll hold one side, tell the other side, you know, okay, let, you know, you go ahead and leave. Then 15 minutes later, they let the other one go.
Right.
But no, they threw us both out at the same time into the same courtyard. So they knew exactly what was going to happen. They knew we were going to get into it. And, you know, that's what happened. But that day, we didn't, neither one of us did anything inside the courthouse. And she was ready with a statement saying that I had caused a problem all day. And I got into an argument with the bailiffs in the back of the room. None of that was true. Every bit of it was a lie. So I came, you know, knowing that she has the ability. She does not care about lying.
Mm-hmm. So, which is sad to know. Let's talk about the confessions. You, again, probably are more well-versed on this than I am. I wasn't aware until I started following the trial that there's been so many confessions and non-confessions mm-hmm. and confessions taken back, and who did he really talk to on the phone and who was listening to the phone conversations. I mean, it is hard to keep track of, man.
Richard Allen is at least, I think, the third or fourth person I know of that's confessed to the murders.
Yes, yes. I've heard of at least two others. Yes, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
So initially, I think what you have to look at, and I hope, and I know what you were talking about a minute ago before we went on the air, we were talking about this a little bit, and I want you to elaborate on that a little bit more here in a moment, that you hope the jury understands and doesn't get confused by the confessions. But I want to go back to the very beginning of this, when he was first approached and investigated, and they started to get a little more pointed in their questioning to Richard Allen, and basically got to the point where they accused him of it and said, we've got the evidence, and police are allowed to lie to you. That is
right.
They get that in the Supreme Court. But it seemed like, I think you have to look at someone's first reaction to give some real truth to what the truth is and how they really felt. And it seems like Richard Allen's reaction was an innocent man reaction. He was standing up and yelling and basically saying, I didn't do it, and I'm not going to admit to doing something I didn't do. And he did that for 8 hours, man.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden we start hearing this confession and that confession. And then he talked to his wife and his mom, and you know, we start hearing back and forth. And I think you have to go back and give some credence to his initial reaction, which was everything an innocent person would do.
Right. Right. And when he, I think the stark difference between the two Richard Allens, the one that stood up to the cops that day and said, no way, I didn't do this, and then the one that's in his cell saying, you know, and notice the wording. This is very important. At no time did he say, you know, I will tell them everything they want to know. See, that's what they've been saying in the news and everything. Mm-hmm. Well, he says, I'll tell them anything they want to know. No, that's not what he's saying. He's saying, I'll tell them whatever they want me to say.
Yes.
That's what he was saying.
Yes.
He was saying, look, whatever they want to hear, I'm going to say that. You know, he just wanted to end it.
Yes.
You know, and he wanted them to leave his wife alone.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think that was another thing that he was worried about.
I think that was pretty clear, at least from some of the reports I had seen. And again, I hope the jury is able to make those minute distinguishing differences, you know.
Mm-hmm. I hope so too.
with the confessions, I know you were concerned about, and I think I'm assuming correctly, that you're afraid that the 12 jurors might get there might be something lost with so much being thrown at them confession wise that it's hard for them to keep track, or they may have been keeping track and maybe they counted more times where he admitted to it than more times that he didn't admit to it, and you know, maybe they're keeping track that way or something. Why do you think that's important, that the defense really lays out the confessions and what he was thinking in their closing statements, which I'm sure they will?
Right. They were able to show a video. They had to, you know, at first the judge wasn't going to let it in, and they had to fight for it. But they were able to show videos that they made that just documented his deterioration over the months. They had things like him running around naked in his cell, eating his own feces and, you know,
right,
like smearing it all over himself, screaming, you know, I killed him, things right, like that. But he would, like, be on his bed, on his little pallet or whatever, and then just fling himself at the steel door head first and just bang into it with his head.
Wow.
they were dosing him with Halidol. They were giving him frequent injections you know, and he, I just think that it was important that the jury understand what kind of mental state he was in, because then after a while, by the time they let him call his family and talk about it, he seems like he's a little calmer. But by this point, he's just defeated, and he's just telling them, look, yes. I'm just going to tell them what they want to hear.
Yes.
I'm going to get it over with and say I did it, you know. That's basically what he's telling them. So I'm not as concerned as I was before, because I didn't think at first that they were going to get the videos in. But they did get the videos in, so I think the jury is going to be able to see. And according to what I've heard, the reactions of the jury yesterday, they did not look very happy. They looked like they kept giving, you know, casting looks over toward the state's, you know, end of the table and everything. And
like, how and dare you guys sort of, give him all these drugs and let him wither away like that and become psychotic and crazy?
Yeah, the difference is what's going to do it, I think. It's them seeing him, you know, standing up to them saying, I'm not going to admit to something I didn't do, and then walking out and calling the detective an a-hole, you know,
right,
things
right,
like that.
Right. All things you know, that an innocent person would do.
Yeah, they're going to see that, and then they're going to see this shell of a man who's in pieces, you know.
Right.
And they've threatened his daughter, and they've threatened his wife. I mean, that to me, what you spoke of where they're allowed to lie, that's called the Reed technique. And Jerry Holman uses that a lot. And for him to be telling Rick, you know, oh, you're going to drag your wife and daughter into this. Mm-hmm. What does that even mean?
Right.
How is he dragging his wife? No, you're dragging them in.
Yes,
Jerry,
right.
You.
Right. You know? You're the one going to make their life hell.
Yeah, I don't understand that one.
Just because you can, you're a cop. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got, I guess the defense has actually already called a witness or two. I don't expect, you know, all the pundits are saying maybe mid-November is when this thing might go to the jury for deliberation, and I think that's probably accurate. Do you expect the defense to come out and try to put one or two or three theories out there and keep pushing it as much as Judge Gohl will let them, and they're going to keep throwing things at the wall and see if it'll stick and really push her over the next week or two? To the point where she's frustrated, but she can't show that because we're right in the middle of a trial. And do you think they'll try to like get under her skin or hit this thing head on?
Well, if it were me, I would try to get under her skin, but they probably won't do it that way.
Right, right.
I think what they'll probably do is there are many, many rumors that have been going around for years and years, and there were so many people at the bridge that day that tell a story about other people that they saw that no one has talked about being there and so forth.
Yeah.
And just the fact that you have all of these sketches. Now, they didn't want the sketches in either. You know, the state fought to keep the sketches out.
Okay.
And people say, well, you know, sketches aren't photographs. I get that. But the reasoning they used, and I'm kind of paraphrasing Russ McQuaid here.
Mm-hmm.
He said that they were afraid that if they showed these sketches to the jury, because these sketches did not lead to the arrest of Richard Allen.
Correct.
And they don't look like Richard Allen. So he Correct. Said the state's afraid if they show these sketches to the jury, they might think that maybe the police arrested the wrong man.
Right. It might actually give them.
Yeah, that's kind of what a defense attorney is supposed to make the jury think.
Right, right, exactly. Yeah, wow, I never thought about that. That's interesting.
Yeah,
yeah.
You know, so, but to me, okay. Kevin, if you think about it, Delphi being such a small community, everybody knows everybody, and you have two or three people that were at that park that day on those trails that were sketched that nobody knows who they are.
Yes.
And nobody seems to care. Yes. And two girls were murdered that day.
Yes.
You know, but they've got their man, so that's all they care about. well, what about these guys in the sketches that nobody knows who they are and nobody has bothered to try and find out? It's just crazy.
I think the defense has to hammer that home over the next week or so here, because there is there's all kinds of reasonable doubt out there already. And I think if they did their homework, which I'm sure they did, they're going to create even more reasonable doubt going into this.
Right, right. I would think they would be leaning heavily on those sketches, but there again, the judge has said they can't. Mm-hmm. They can't talk about the sketches. So
I wonder how many people, if the judge will allow, or maybe she's already ruled on it. This may sound like, I may sound like an idiot even asking. Do you think that if the defense wants to submit one or two other people who have admitted to this, will that be allowed?
I'm not sure. I know they want to bring in Kagan Klein,
mm-hmm.
but I don't think they want to bring him to testify about the crime itself. They want him to testify about how he was leaned on to confess.
Yeah.
Because that's the story the defense is telling right now, is that these people either did not want to go after the real killers or were so inept they couldn't see the real killers right in front of their faces when they had them.
Right.
And they decided that, you know, they're going to go after Richard Allen. They're going to make him, you know, but before that, they tried to lean on Kagan Klein and get him to confess.
I remember that.
They tried to lean on Ron Logan and get him to confess, you know, and they want to bring in James Haas, who was Ron Logan's cellmate, and saw how he was treated, because of course Ron Logan has passed.
Mm-hmm.
And they want to bring in James Chadwell and talk to him about how he was leaned on to confess. See, they need a confession,
right?
Because they don't have the evidence. And that's what they've been trying to do. That's why they put Richard Allen in a prison away from everybody, because they wanted to break him and they wanted him to confess.
Right.
And he never did. You know, well, he did, but
right.
You know, back they had to break him first.
Right. Under what circumstances? Yeah, the extenuating mm-hmm. circumstances. Plus, like you said, there's no DNA. There's no fingerprints. There's no trace evidence. I just find that awful suspicious, too.
And the strange thing is, the video now that we were told about, we were sold a lie.
Mm-hmm.
We were told that the girls noticed a man following them on the bridge, and that Libby was very sneaky and very, you know, smart, and pretended she was filming Abby walking on the bridge, but she leaned to the side and, you know, actually captured this guy walking on the bridge.
Right.
Well, that's not what happened at all. You know, when you first view the actual video, and it's not 43 seconds, it's more like 35 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
And when you view that video, you can't even see the bridge guy. You have to be shown, you have to like slow the video down and you have to be shown where he is. Because rather than filming him, it looks like what happened is Libby may not even know that she was recording at the time.
Mm.
And she puts the phone down, and for just a fraction of a second, you catch a guy walking on the bridge way back in the background.
Mm-hmm.
And they took that video. They found that. They looked at the video. They saw the guy walking. And they now admit that they extrapolated him, that little piece, and did what they call stabilizing. They changed it around and made it look like it was an upright video of a man walking on a bridge. That's not what it was at all.
Oh, my gosh.
You know, they got like a fraction of a second, and then they looped it to make it look like he was walking. So Libby was not even trying to film this guy. We don't even know if this guy knows anything that he was captured on film or not.
Oh, my goodness.
He's definitely too far away to have been the man that said down the hill.
Right.
And then we hear that one of the girls said, is he down there? You know, they're up on the hill, and I believe it was Abby said, is he down there? And then you hear Abby say to Libby, well, don't leave me up here by myself. I think they were there to meet somebody,
mm-hmm.
and they were looking to see if he was down there. Because you hear Abby or you hear Libby say, well, there's no trail here, so we have to go down here.
Mm.
You know, maybe he said, I'll meet you at the end of the trail or something like that.
Right.
You never know.
And kids being that age could have been, you know, very vulnerable meeting
mm-hmm.
someone for who knows what. if in fact that was the case. Well, Rick, again, the name of your podcast is Delphi After Dark, and you can find that just about anywhere. Is there an easy way for us to find that?
Yeah, it's on YouTube. You just go to YouTube and say, you know, just type in Delphi After Dark, and it'll come up.
And from the way I understand, you're doing at least one a day during the trial here?
During the trial, yes, except on the weekends. I might do one on Saturday, but during the trial, I'm doing at least one podcast a day, one show. Sometimes I do two if there's enough to talk about, but I'm doing at least one every day.
Very good. I'll try to throw some links up to our website as well. I know you want what I want, which is justice in this, and I hope we certainly find that out. And I hope you and I can talk again once the jury comes back with whatever they decide to do, and then we'll talk about it from there. But we're hoping for justice. That's the main thing.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
All right, Rick Snay, host of Delphi After Dark, the podcast. I'm Kevin Keith for the KNS Radio Network.